Ring the bells that still can ring. Forget your perfect offering. There's a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. Leonard Cohen from the Anthem in 1992.
Hello and welcome to Duke's Conversation series, where we interview interesting personalities relevant to the Namibian literary context. Today we have Justice Smuts, a current judge of the Supreme Court of Namibia and the author of Death, Detention and Disappearance, a forthcoming book about the rule of law in pre-independence Namibia. Justice Smuts was a prominent human rights lawyer in Namibia's pre-liberation years and as an attorney argued for the release of political prisoners as part of the UN's peace plan in 1989. In 1988, Justice Smuts founded the Legal Assistance Center of Namibia and served as its founding director from 1988 to 1992. He also practiced as an advocate in Windhoek from 1988 as head of the LAC and later from 1991 to 1992 as a member of the Windhoek Bar until he was appointed a judge of the High Court in 2011. In 2015, he was appointed to the Supreme Court. Justice Smuts holds an LLM from Harvard Law School and received an award as a human rights monitor from Human Rights Watch in 1990 and was also elected as an Orville Schell Junior Fellow at Yale Law School in that same year. He was recently chosen as a member of the American Academy for Arts and Sciences in 2019. We'd like to start off with you reading a part of the work from your forthcoming book and just tell us a bit about the part that you're going to read and then we'll dive right into it.
Yes, I'm taking two passages from the epilogue, which is, as it would suggest, the final chapter in the book, which tries to take the threads that have been woven before in the book together and reach some conclusions and to make some observations about those years. Those years when we were asserting rights and the law in the courts and about the cases that are described in the book. So if I can just start then at the beginning of the epilogue, it goes as follows. For years, the apartheid state created the illusion of scrupulously following and upholding the law, even laws that facilitated harsh state action against subjects. These laws included those which authorized forced removals and detention without trial, restricted movement on grounds of race, conscripted people to serve in its army, and made interracial love a crime. There was a fastidious enforcement of these noxious laws. Under P.W. Botha, an assiduous militarization of the apartheid state brought about a discernible shift in the approach to the law. The end would justify the means, no matter how unlawful and objectionable the means were and became. When stifling dissent or dealing with opponents could no longer fit comfortably within the omnipotent battery of draconian laws, or where the military engaged in excesses, the law was to be overridden by indemnity provisions or simply breached with impunity. And then I give some examples and then I continue that theme as follows. The end justifying the means meant routine torture of detainees. Kufuor was established and operated upon that principle too. The means employed by that unit resulted in countless deaths and disappearances. That count remained unmeasured because so many victims landed in shallow and anonymous graves. It is no coincidence that the notorious Flok Plaas death squad that emerged in South Africa in the 1980s was headed by Eugene de Kock, who cut his teeth in the callous illegal conduct as a company commander of Kufuor from 1979 to 1983. A unit that prided itself on its kill rate rewarded its members handsomely in financial terms for each kill of an alleged insurgent before or after capture and included alleged collaborators, speaks of a state that had abandoned any vestiges of a moral compass. The descent into lawless conduct extended beyond military and paramilitary matters and the combating of insurgency. The power of the state was also unleashed upon political opponents of the regime and upon political activity not favored by the military. There was the inevitable slide into the opaque world of covert units that engaged in extrajudicial killings. This trend is amply demonstrated by the murder of Shafidi, when the military disrupted a legal swapper meeting and culminated in the calculated killing of Anton in 1989. The incremental militarization and resultant undermining of the law during those dark days of the 1980s placed heavy demands upon my approach to practicing law, premised upon and driven by a belief in the value of law as a means to bring about justice. Amid harsh laws, the invocation of indemnities to avoid scrutiny and security force lawlessness and terror, holding the state and its agents to account became increasingly difficult. But it also became ever more compelling to do so. What was crucial was maintaining a belief in the law and rights by assisting those caught up in and endeavouring to take every opportunity to challenge those methods, practices and injustices by invoking the law and seeking to vindicate legal standards.
Justice Mutz, thank you so much for reading from Death, Detention and Disappearance. From the epilogue alone, it sounds like this is a very, very incisive and poignant read for the Namibian public, not only those from a legal scholarship background, but for the ordinary Namibian who's interested in our history. Having written this book, what do you think its primary reception will be in Namibia for now, once it's released?
The book is really an attempt to record some of the cases and events that occurred during that period inside the country. And it takes a few cases and themes to do so. And it involves the impact of those themes I read about upon the lives of ordinary people that are depicted and featured in the book. And it's to tell that history for the people of Namibia so that the truth can be known about what happened during those years. And also that we can have the opportunity to learn from some of those experiences and to pick up some of those themes and see why it was so important for people to stand up during that times. Why some of the ordinary people that were involved in the resistance during those years, unfortunately, haven't been properly recognized for their roles. But it's this book actually is to provide and give them some recognition for that. But it's why it was so important for people to do that. And it was not the leaders and necessarily, but it's about people living in the country who got caught up in the conflict and took a stance as well. And it's about their lives.
Yeah, so it's not necessarily just a book about, for example, the vaunted heroic leaders in Namibia. It's about the everyday struggles, for example, that the ordinary Namibian during the 1980s would have faced under the apartheid regime as the country trotted towards independence. So the ordinary Namibian can read this book and find either someone that they never heard about or even someone that they've heard about but never knew enough, correct?
Yes, I think so. And I hope that those people who were involved then receive the recognition due to them because of their courageous actions during those years. And it's about the conditions during those years, both not just in the court, both in that context, but also, more importantly, on the ground, what was happening in the north, the curfew, what that entailed, how it affected and impacted on people's lives. So those are some of the themes in the book.
Yeah. Can you give us perhaps a timeline of the cases in the book, when the earliest one occurs and then the latest one in the book?
The book is essentially about cases during the 80s. I started out in the beginning of 1980 But the first major case that came my way, featured in the book, is started in 1983,
mm-hmm.
carried on in 1984, and it goes right up during the 80s, during those years, up to independence.
Okay, and out of all of these cases, let's talk about the geographic coverage of these cases. Where do they come from? A lot of people, for example, I find, believe that the liberation struggle only happened in the north, or that it only happened in Windhoek, or that it happened in particular parts of the country. But Namibia and its vastness, its peoples come from many places. So can you give us a little bit about the spread of the cases, where they come from and where these legal things take place?
Yeah, many of the incidents, the major incidents, did have their origin in the north, but not all.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most significant cases and accounts during that period and featured in the book is the death of Emmanuel Shafidi, and that happened in Kadatura.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also reference to the security police in Walvis Bay. They were particularly harsh and unpleasant during those years. And there's some discussion of that and reference to cases during that time. And then, of course, people were held in Mariental in that military detention camp for over 6 years without trial.
Mm-hmm.
The people are caught in the course of Operation Reindeer. And Operation Reindeer was the military raid which scuppered the implementation of Resolution 435 in 1978, probably deliberate attempt by the military to do so. That was a raid which was one of the significant events in Namibian history. It was two-pronged. The one component was to attack the Kasinga base,
mm-hmm.
where many people were killed. And the other lesser known component of it was to attack several smaller bases just north of the Namibian border in the western part of Ovambo,
mm-hmm.
just north of the Ombolanta area. And there they brought back about 200 people as captives.
Oh, wow.
And they were held without trial in secret for nearly 6 years.
In Mariental.
Oh, wow. So some cases happened in different parts of the country, and the majority probably were in the northern zone, because that's where the most egregious human rights abuses were. But there were also cases that are covered in the Windhoek area, other and Walvis Bay, and I also must mention even in the suburbs of Windhoek. Anton Lubovsky was gunned down outside his house, and the book also refers to
mm-hmm.
to that killing. So there is a spread, but a lot of the events occurred in the north.
Mm-hmm. My understanding of Namibian history is still being developed. So I, for example, would not have known that Walvis Bay was a big player in the human rights abuses during the liberation struggle. Could you perhaps tell us a little bit more about what was happening in Walvis Bay in and around that time?
Walvis Bay had quite an activist community.
Mm.
And one of the really good things about Walvis Bay then, and I still think it's probably the case today, is that Kwisabmund was a very unified community. There was very little tribalism, and everybody was united against the apartheid state. And the youth in particular became quite active and vocal in their opposition to the apartheid state, as did organized workforce. So as that increased, there was some resistance. And the security police there were particularly nasty.
Mm.
And people were detained and tortured. We dealt with a case involving electric shock treatment in Walvis Bay.
Oh, wow. That's gruesome.
Yeah, and I think also there were some very effective activists there. One of the community leaders were very strong and provided very important leadership.
Mm.
And it became worse in the 80s because South Africa decided to assert direct rule over Walvis Bay and not through Windhoek. So it became administered as part of the Cape Province and not as part of the rest of Namibia. And with that, there was certainly on the part of the security police a greater degree of bloody-mindedness, really.
Yeah.
I think you can call it nothing else, in the way in which they treated dissent.
Yeah, and that basically happened in this, what I call this little quaint fishing town by the sea, that for me is just a place in the sand dunes with ships and cargo coming in and out of the country. I would not have associated Walvis Bay with all of these, with this long history of struggle. And I think that's one of the good things about this book being released. It's another step towards Namibia archiving its memory, its history, what happened, how it happened, why it happened. And the book, since I've seen some of the earlier chapters, is actually quite accessible to the Namibian public.
Well, the attempt has been to, on my side, to write it not for lawyers at all.
Mm.
It's actually written for everybody.
Mm.
And I've certainly tried to make it accessible and to have as little as possible legal...
Have it in legalese.
Jargon.
Yeah.
It's just really to try and avoid that.
Yeah.
I must just say to you about Walvis Bay, just one other thing, is that Walvis Bay is quite important in the political history of the country because quite a lot of the organized labor started there already in the late 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with Steve Dawes and people organizing there. I know that through Emmanuel Shafidi, who started out there.
Okay.
And Hilal Shetiweti, who was mm-hmm. in Robben Island.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a very important place where people became activists. We had a system of migrant labor during those years.
Yeah.
And people would come down from the north, work there and have to go back because of the Swanlow regime. But during the time they were there, they became quite active.
Yeah.
So it does have quite a history of political activism.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think this book is one of the reasons why we really need to make a greater push towards recording our own history, because this towns in Namibia all have an important footprint in our journey towards liberation. So it was interesting to hear about Walvis Bay being a major part of it. Because as I mentioned, for me, it's always a little quaint little town, but it's got this very dense history of struggle and played a major part in our move towards independence. My next question is basically about how you came about writing this book. I think as a work of history, has it been long in your mind? Is it a collection of drafts and pieces that you worked on for a long period of time, or did it come to you once upon a time as a clear project that this must be done?
It wasn't something which I had intended to do over the years at all.
Mm.
And it really was the result of pressure being put upon me by a number of friends and colleagues from different walks of life who felt that this needed to be captured and for posterity.
Yeah.
And that's how it happened.
Yeah. I think I actually think a lot of writing projects do come from external pressure where, for example, you have a story within you or you've experienced something, but you're always hesitant to talk or write about it until someone says, you know what, just as much, this is a story that needs to be recorded. And then from that external pressure, how did you come to the physical act of writing the book?
Yeah, it was quite a few people said to me, it was in fact my duty, in fact, to write some of these things down. And two of the people involved in saying that to me had proposed me for a writing workshop at the wonderful setting in Italy of the Rockefeller Foundation at Bellagio on the Lake Como.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a month long, this writing workshop that you can attend. It's not really a workshop, you just go there to write.
Yeah.
And I went there and it was wonderful, and I was able to write about a third of the book. During the month that I was there, I was very, very focused on the book and on my writing, and that gave it the impetus. Mm. And once I managed to write that quite major chunk,
yeah,
I then, during subsequent court vacations, when I have time off, I'd write a chapter each time.
Yeah.
Until it eventually became finished 3.5 years later. So it started really in 2015 when I went to Bellagio and the middle of the year, and then it finished at the end of last year, early this year, 2019, as the manuscript was then sent to the publisher.
All right, that's very interesting. And during this process, you said that you had to cut chunks of time from your daily schedule. If you are on leave, you would, for example, be working on it. So it really just came down to discipline, to putting the craft through its paces every day.
Yes, it did actually come down to discipline. Mm. And I can confirm that, because it was quite difficult during court term to be able to do much. But what I did manage to do during court term and weekends and that was to get some of the research done, collect materials and speak to people, conducted some interviews with a view to writing the next chapter when I had an amount of time that I could block off. I found that I needed to block off a bit of time to be able to sit down and write the next chapter.
Yeah.
But during the ensuing period, or preceding and also afterwards, I would certainly have in mind the following chapter and do some of the preparatory work so that when I had time off, I'd be able to slot straight back into it work hard to get that done. And sometimes I did even two chapters if they were shortest chapters during those periods, and especially if I had quite a lot of the materials available and gone through them carefully and spoken to people. But it certainly did boil down to discipline.
Mm-hmm. And as a work of history, not only having started it abroad, but also working on it over here, what challenges did you face in terms of research, in terms of materials that were available? And you're also writing about, in terms of history, not a very distant past, but a largely also inaccessible past. So what challenges did you face in terms of writing that book for that, not only for the length of time, but about that period in history?
It was very difficult, in fact, because the firm where I worked from 1980 to 1988 had unfortunately destroyed all these files, which...
As in the records were destroyed.
They completely. Were destroyed.
Yeah. Not lost, when they moved destroyed. Office,
they were destroyed. Okay. They were considered, they were old, and much later they moved office. And it was really sad, because I left all those files with that firm when I left the firm.
Mm.
I did have keep some of the materials.
Mm.
But one of the other aspects I must mention is that we didn't keep diaries then. Okay. I was just checking this with Gwen Lister, because we never
Gwen Lister, by the way, is just to interrupt, is the editor, the founding editor of the Namibian, the country's largest newspaper.
Yes. We both couldn't keep diaries and many notes, because we knew that when the security police came to search our homes, that we would be exposing our people that we worked with.
Mm.
And in one occasion, one of the people who played a really central role in probably the most important case that I give an account of in the book, his name was Joseph Katofa, and he was detained because of his absolutely crucial role in helping us to bring that case to court.
Mm.
So we had to really protect people too. So it was very difficult to keep notes and to keep diaries of events because of that.
Yeah.
But I've been able to go through the archives of the High Court. I was with the assistance of some of the people who work there. We were able to trace many of the court files and to see court records. And that was really crucial.
Mm.
And then I've also spoken to many people who were involved during those years. We've mined our memories.
Mm-hmm.
And also, unfortunately, some of the people that were very important during those years have died. So that's also made things a little bit difficult. So it has been quite a challenge.
Yeah. And I think, I think with your book coming out, there has to be a greater impetus towards recording this history, because this history is basically passing us by. The people who were involved in that struggle have either, as you said, passed on or are, worst case scenario, going to pass on soon, and we need to get this memory. And I want to touch on something that you just mentioned about the difficulty of keeping notes, because those notes could not only land you in trouble, but also people you are working with in very, very grievous trouble. As a writer, one of the things that you need is notes, because memory is a very treacherous thing. If something happened yesterday, as early as yesterday, or even as early this morning, when you go back to it, it hasn't quite occurred in the same way. So as a work of history, with those gaps having occurred, people having passed on, court records being destroyed, or files being lost and destroyed, what was the single most, the hardest thing that you had to overcome? For example, a person that you interviewed that was no longer there. How did you overcome that challenge?
It was quite difficult. One of my friends helped me, because during those years, I actually sent letters to friends. I didn't send a letter written. I'd record on the old tape recordings, a cassette tape, and send them of my news, because when I did some of those cases, there were so many incidents and that happened that I wanted to relate the story, and I did that. And one of the people sent me back some of those tapes.
Interesting, lovely.
Yeah, and I was able to pick up quite a lot. And there were some notes that I kept of the most important case in the book, and I'm so pleased I kept them, because I used them, and there's even dialogue in the book, because I was able to record in my notebook some things. And I kept that notebook because those people, we'd already done the case, and there would be no danger to them. And it was, in fact, about what had happened in the case, which emerged in court. So I was able to keep that, but it was more personal recollection of some of the things that occurred. But in other areas, I've conducted several interviews, and as I say, I've gone through records, because it's been a challenge, because there's a paucity of material.
Yeah.
But I think what is so important is to be true and to stick to the truth. And if I did not know something categorically, did not include it.
Okay.
I did not speculate.
Yeah. And out of all the cases that you've covered in this seems pretty extensive book, which one stood out the most for you, and why?
Well, the most important case I did for both myself and in as a person, I think, but most important in terms of my personal growth as a lawyer and in understanding how to challenge injustice in the future, was the case involving those people who were captured in Angola and were held in secret in Mariental for 6 years without trial. That was a watershed for me, because I really learned so much, and I worked with such very fine lawyers, but I also learned so much from the community that I worked with in building the case in the north. The risk that they were facing in being involved, and in fact, as I said, Katofa was involved, and he was detained as a consequence of his assistance to us. And also about the reality of the system, the militarization in the northern area, the impact on that as a practice, just in little practical terms, on the curfew, in trying to do something like that was quite an obstacle to overcome. But fundamentally, most importantly, it was an important learning curve in how to challenge the system in the courts. Because we didn't win the case. But I learned then it wasn't about winning cases in court.
Okay, what was it about for you then?
Well, it is about we lost the case in terms of the outcome in the courtroom, but we won the issue.
But
the people were all released as a consequence of the case. Yeah. The injustice was exposed.
Yeah,
and it galvanized the churches, a lot of people, the youth, together in being far more strategic in challenging human rights abuses going forward. It had a big impact in that sense. So it was a big victory, even though we lost it in court. But it wasn't about winning in court.
So you had managed to ring the bell that needed to be rung.
Yes, and it wasn't a perfect offering from my side because I was in my 20s and I had so little experience. It was probably way out of my depth. And it didn't matter that you couldn't bring your perfect offering to the table at that time. You just did your best with what you could and what was at your disposal. And in that way, you try to find a crack and let the light in.
We just had a very interesting conversation with Justice Smuts about his book, Death, Detention, and Disappearance. But getting away from the book, I would really like to talk to you about your reading interests, what you enjoy reading and how that, for example, has impacted or influenced your writing. I find that myself personally, when I have to write fiction, I wind up reading more nonfiction because I'm always on the lookout for how to simplify an idea, how to condense something to its essence. And strangely enough, I've also found that nonfiction writers read more fiction in order to see how a story is told so that they can share their facts with the reader. So for you, as a Supreme Court justice, but as the author of Death, Detention and Disappearance, what are your reading interests? What do you enjoy reading, and which books, for example, have affected you as a writer?
I enjoy reading a wide range of books, both fiction and non-fiction. So and over the years I've enjoyed that very much. I did English in my BA as part of my law degree.
Which university?
At Stellenbosch University. And the English faculty at that time was good. And the critical analysis which they taught with regard to literature, including poetry, was really of a high standard. And I was much more interested actually in English than in the law, because the law was not taught with any view to an inquiring mind or critical analysis of it.
Okay.
It was more taught to try and equip you to become a good attorney to run a practice.
Yeah, yeah.
It did not really teach you to think there. So in the English faculty, there was quite a lot of that, and I really enjoyed that. And we gave us reading lists, and in my first year, a book that had an impression upon me for many years is Crime and Punishment by Dostoevsky. And I really enjoyed books like that which discuss moral conflict and issues and choices that people have to make. Two more contemporary work that comes out, which every year they're always exciting new books that see the light of day, and I'm always very excited by the new releases.
All right. So in your, if you were to talk about five books that have affected you profoundly, would you say that Crime and Punishment would be one of them?
Yes, and in another book from that very time, which was also, which we studied, was Camus' The Plague.
Okay, by Albert Camus.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. He's French, Moroccan, French writer?
Yes, French, Algerian.
Algerian, yeah, yeah.
That's a great book, The Plague. I really think it's a great work. And then later in life, those are two. Later on, when I started in practice, I really enjoyed V.S. Naipaul's work tremendously.
Yeah, which one in particular?
You know, I've read everything he wrote, and I like humorous books, The one that influenced me the most was actually Bend in the River.
Okay. The one that I despise the most from V.S. Naipaul.
Yeah. I know it's a very controversial book, but I think it's so superbly written.
Yeah.
And I've also really enjoyed the biography that's been done on him by, I think it's John Green. Mm-hmm. And then also from just after that, there was this absolute breath of fresh air that came with Arundhati Roy's God of Small Things.
Yeah, I love that book. It's the book that never ends for me.
Tremendously good book. And then more recently, there's a tremendously good essay about power and the impact on life, and that's the book by Julian Barnes about Shostakovich, and it's called
The Noise of Time.
The Noise of Time.
Yeah. So you would, for example, summarize it as Crime and Punishment number one by Dostoevsky, The Plague by Albert Camus, Bend in the River by V.S. Naipaul. Number four is The God of Small Things, and number five would be The Noise of Time by Julian Barnes.
Yeah, it's not in that sequence.
Yeah, not in that sequence.
But that for me is chronologically how I came across those writers is during that time. That's a chronological.
Yeah. And going away from books, what other storytelling mediums do you enjoy in terms of music, in terms of film? What other interests do you have besides, for example, printed literature?
Yeah, I like music very much and also like film.
Mm.
Both have been key interests since I was growing up.
Yeah, and which artists, for example, from the music domain most appeal to you, or genres or types or works?
Well, I had a small amount of classical training when I was at high school, and I've never lost my love for classical music. And I listen to a huge range of classical music all the time. In fact, I write with it a lot of the time, and with jazz. And of the classical composers, well, I really do like opera a lot, like some of the bel canto composers. But I think the composers I listen to the most are Handel and Beethoven, and especially Beethoven's chamber music. And enjoy jazz a lot. Yeah,
what jazz musicians stand out for you?
There's so many, but Southern African. I've always had a huge admiration for Abdullah Ibrahim because I've seen him perform on a couple of occasions. But I do like his work tremendously. Yeah. But I do like a lot of jazz and a lot of contemporary music. Even Leonard Cohen, as you heard, and Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan was a very important figure for me when I was growing up, and also in those early years, formative years, because he was a protest singer. He stood up against the authorities. And he was a very important symbol to so many of us, and certainly to me.
Yeah, I mean, even to this day, I still like his songwriting prowess. I think my two favorite songs from Dylan are The Hurricane, about Reuben Hurricane Carter. The way he weaves the story in that song is absolutely magical. And another one that stuck with me for the longest time, and whenever I'm writing and I have to, a character, for example, has to confront the times in which he lives, I like the times they're changing. I just like that phrase in the story in which he weaves about the changing nature of US life over there during those times. Was just one of the best storytelling examples that I've always liked. I thoroughly enjoyed having this conversation with you, talking about your forthcoming book, looking forward to it, and we shall definitely let everybody know about prospective launch dates and places it'll be available. But from me and from the Duke Collective, we're very, very pleased to have had you as our first guest, to be in conversation with you. And we look forward to everything that comes forward.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much.
This conversation series is published by Duk, a free and independent online literary magazine produced in Windhoek, Namibia. It publishes short fiction, non-fiction, poetry, and visual art from Namibia, the Namibian diaspora, and Africa. To get in touch with the Duk Collective, drop them an email at win@duklitmag.com. That is win@duklitmag.com. You can also catch up with them on their social media profiles, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Everywhere, it's Duk Lit Mag.